If you own a vehicle with less than 200,000 miles and have an auto warranty about to expire or no warranty coverage at all, listen up. CarShield has a low-cost, month-to-month vehicle protection plan that covers more parts than ever. Visit carshield.com/audio to find out how you could pay almost nothing for covered auto repairs. Drivers who activate this vehicle protection today will also receive free roadside assistance, free towing, and car rental options at no additional cost. Get your free quote today at carshield.com/audio. That's carshield.com/audio.
This is John Hall, author of Top of Mind, How to Use Content to Unleash Your Influence and Engage Those Who Matter to You, and you're listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast, helping you keep up with the smartest thinking in the quickly changing field of modern marketing. And now, here's your host, Douglas Burdett.
Hello, thanks for joining me on the Marketing Book Podcast, which was named by LinkedIn as one of 10 podcasts that will make you a better marketer. My goal for this podcast is to help you discover new ideas about what's actually working in modern marketing and sales. Don't worry about taking notes. You can find links to everything discussed in this episode's show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. Also, if you're listening to the show right now, and you're not driving or operating dangerous machinery, please hop on Twitter and tell us where in the world you're listening from. My Twitter handle is MarketingBook. Even better, include a picture of where you are. Today we're joined by John Hall, and we're going to talk about his new book, Top of Mind, Use Content to Unleash Your Influence and Engage Those Who Matter to You. John Hall is a popular keynote speaker and is co-founder and CEO of Influence & Company, a very successful content marketing agency that helps companies and individuals extract and leverage their expertise to create, publish, and distribute content to their key audiences. John has weekly columns for Forbes and Inc. magazine and has contributed to more than 50 publications, including Harvard Business Review, Fast Company, The Washington Post, and Mashable. John has been called, quote, one of the most powerful people in media who you've never met, end quote, by Inc. magazine, and a must-see keynote speaker by Forbes. And, little known fact, John knows every word of the Cabbage Patch Kids song. John, congratulations on Top of Mind, and welcome to the Marketing Book Podcast.
Thanks for having me. I just realized that that bio has got to be shortened up. I felt bad for you there. I was just like, really, it's as simple as I love to, my summary of a bio is that I love to educate people, and I love how you can use content to gain trust.
Yes.
So that's a simple, that's what I would say my simple bio is, but we need to get that shortened.
And that's the interview for this week, folks. It definitely came through. To start out, John, can you tell the story about the conference you attended as a new CEO and the challenges you faced trying to connect with people?
That story is a common one that I tell young entrepreneurs and starting out, or I guess young professionals, because when I was 25 or something, 26 when that happened, and it was a very big wake-up call for me, because I went there and I tend to be somewhat of a confident person, that if you just go somewhere and you treat people well, you can fit in fine. And I went to an event, it was in DC, and I was trying to start conversations with people, and overall people just kind of had their cliques, they had their circles, and I'd try and get in a conversation, you can almost feel what is this guy doing here? And you could tell there was just trust barriers anywhere I went. I was the new kid at school, and just like when you sat at the lunch table at a new school or your first day of high school, you have this feeling and you're never actually comfortable. And so went there, and I remember it was when we were kind of on the fence of if we were going to make it or not and how we were doing as a company. It was very early on, and we had only a couple clients, and I went home that night, think I'd even talk about in the book, I had tears in my eyes, and it even kind of was crying in a way, and told her that it wasn't going to work.
I think that's going to resonate with more entrepreneurs than you realize, John.
I don't have too much pride to say that I was in a hotel room crying with a glass of wine. So it was really, really sad. But I remember that moment and it sucked. But the next day I really went back into that conference and I was confident to said, hey, you know what? I'm going to do everything I can to make this work. And then by the end of that day, I think we had we had got five prospective leads that ended up being clients and kind of taking us to that next level. And so, you know, but it didn't make me forget that feeling that Friday, that first day, and going in there that early that Saturday, is that there's the feeling of heavy trust barriers, whether it's your personal life or for your company. It's a very big challenge to overcome. And from there, I've been on this kind of mission to help companies and individuals not feel that way, to build credibility, authority, trust with a specific audience so that they don't have those barriers.
And that sense of purpose, I thought, was very clear throughout the book. So let's go on and let me ask you, what is or was what you call me marketing?
Well, me marketing is just very centered about what I think is interesting, what I think is good, or what our company thinks is cool. You know, it's very, it happens so often, and it's kind of how we, I grew up at least, and I'm sure, Doug, you grew up the same way, is that, like, we grew up on, like, door-to-door sales, and, you know, I remember selling cheese and sausage and popcorn and all a bunch of other crappy products that shouldn't have been sold at the door-to-door. I'm surprised my neighbors liked me after that, but I remember.
I should interject. I know what you're talking about. When I was a Cub Scout, I sold 100 dozen donuts door to door to raise money for the Scout organization.
Well, at least those were donuts. Like, I mean, like, donuts are still pretty good. I was selling, like, processed cheese and stuff. It was weird. And so when you look back and I look, you know, that was very centered around the benefit is for me. I'm trying to make money off you. I'm trying, at that time, I was trying to get an Indiana Pacers. I don't know why. I think one of my teachers was had a cousin who was in the organization there. And I remember I was trying to get Indiana Pacers tickets. And so the way I was marketing and selling and communicating was about me. It was, what can I do to get my Pacers tickets? And that's very me-centered marketing, me-centered sales. You're not focused on how can I offer the most value to a customer and to an audience. And that's where it should be very, very focused on that. And that's where this rise in the last 10 years of content marketing, thought leadership into more inbound marketing. That's why this rise has occurred, is because people don't want to be sold to all day. They don't want you to only think about them, and they don't want to feel like you're just trying to make money off them. They want to feel like you truly are trying to add as much value for them as possible. And that's what creates a long-term and long-lasting relationship.
Yeah. When I read about the me marketing, I thought of another term that I've heard, which is companies who we all over themselves. And what it means is we this, we that. You can see it with a lot of, like, local bank ads as well, but it's very much focused on themselves. And that's, like you say, that's gone to what you call the you marketing revolution.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's not just about marketing. I call it marketing just because a lot of times that's primarily the area that I'm speaking to, but it's you communication. For example, when I'm communicating just to, let's say yesterday when I was talking to my neighbor, there's there's two ways of communicating. There's thinking about what I think is interesting, how I talk about myself, and how I feel this conversation is going. And I feel good, I feel great, but that's very me-centric. Instead, what I want to get across in this book is that, just like marketing, where you should be centered around the, you know, it should be focused on what's valuable to the audience, it's same way in one-on-one conversation with anybody or how you're communicating. For me, I look at it as simple as, for my neighbor, I need to engage them in a way of what's interesting to them. Like, how can I communicate in a way and care about them enjoying this conversation as well as adding value in their life? And I think that this kind of mindset can influence your life, not just within marketing, but just how you engage others. And that's why I like this message. It obviously has a very, very relatable to the marketing industry, but I think it's also can be used for how you communicate to other individuals, whether it just be a personal conversation you're having with your neighbor.
Absolutely. So let's talk about trust, because you mentioned that as it related to the story you told when you were a young CEO. What does it really mean to be trustworthy, and why do people trust each other?
I mean, in the book, I talk about trust touch points and how trust doesn't happen immediately, and it almost never does, unless there's a specific situation, which I do talk about in the book where, for example, if you are there for someone when they really need you the most and you offer something so much value. Like, for example, if Doug bails me out of jail when he was like, there, nobody else would bail me out of jail. And
now,
Doug's
for
there.
The listener's benefit, I promise not to ever bring that up, but go ahead, John.
Yeah, you know, we're in a trust circle, right? But yeah, but that's a moment where we can create a substantial amount of trust, where that is a case where there's rare cases like that. Those moments are hard to, you know, find and be super deliberate about. They just happen. The other ones are very deliberate and strategic, and it's a mindset of trust touch points. How in the journey between you and another person, or you and an audience, or you and a customer, how are you having these trust touch points that hit them at different times so that they naturally think of you and you start moving from their short-term to long-term memory as a trusted person or company. And so, for example, in the book, I'll talk about a lot of trust touch points. One is helping others. So if you help someone, like, for example, Doug, if you reach out to me and you say, hey, I need a connection. I'd love to speak at this conference. I know you're connected to the speaker director. And I say, happy to help out, Doug. Here you go. You know, here is Laura or Jessica, whoever that conference director is. I'm happy to help you out. There's just a moment of trust where I helped you out when you needed it there. Or it could be that I'm writing an article and I mention you in one of my blog, you know, personal blog posts or something we do in the company site. That could be a way where you're like, oh, thanks a lot for helping me out again. There's all the, or it's just simple me retweeting or sharing your content out and being an advocate of your content. Those are all different things that have these trust touch points over time. And as you do more and more of them at different points of the journey with someone, you start going from their short-term memory to long-term memory.
So then let's go down to how to do a lot of this, where the rubber meets the road. And let me quote from the book. You said, one of the most effective ways to enrich the lives of your target audience is to help fulfill their hunger for relevant, engaging information and insights. And later you say, education is the most important trust point because knowledge is power. When you educate people, you are empowering them. So let's go even further than that. And you talk about creating content, but you're saying that you, can you explain why the written word is really what you have to do before you start to do all the other things that are available as it relates to creating and distributing content?
Sure. Yeah, I'll start off with your kind of first point with that quote. And that quote is, and to clarify what I mean behind that is that when you're, when you look at all the trust touch points that you can do, there's a variety of ways to, like, there's tons of ways to create trust. However, when it comes down to it, the most scalable form, the most scalable way to do that is through education. And also the most common way to earn trust from trusted advisors. Because when you think about it, who are the most trusted people in your life? They're a lot of times advisors, their teachers, their parents, their mentors, all of these people, the common denominator is that they all educate you and make you better. And so when you look at that, that is a very powerful tool, which that it just shows you how powerful education truly is to gain trust, because it ultimately brings the best out of people. And so that's where, when you land on what are, you know, what is for me the most important trust touch point, it's that, because of that factor, but then also because it's very, very scalable compared to, for example, helping others. I can only help you out a certain times of year. I mean, I can't, like, just sit there and be like, every day, how can I help Doug out? I really need to help him out every single day. You, as much as I'd love to help do that for friends and colleagues,
I appreciate that.
I just can't. It's not scalable. And so you have to look at, so what is scalable? Well, it goes to, with education, it goes to, well, content. Okay, well, content's a big general area. Is there, there's podcasts, there's video content, there's written content. They're all over the place. There's different types of content. And for me, I'm not saying that I don't like video. I don't like podcasts. I think they're great. Actually, I think they're phenomenal tools. However, starting out when you are, a big problem with some companies is that they start out and they're like, oh my God, we're going to do interactive content. Let's jump in interactive content or a crazy Snapchat campaign. And they simply don't even have a content strategy set up with written digital content, which is, out of all the things, a lot of times the easiest to scale, can be used across different, you know, sales, used in SEO, used in social, used in recruiting. You can use it in so many different ways. It's this asset that, you know, if you set up a content strategy that is clear, it's got your messaging, your goals, and there's a process associated with, you know, getting that content created and distributed, then as you bring in things like video, podcasts, Snapchat campaigns, whatever it is, you have this core part, way of communicating, which is very, very strong, and it makes everything else stronger. And so it's because you have those processes set up, you have this natural habit. And that's where in the book I talk about that, is that the most effective way to do something well over time is to create a habit of doing it. It makes sense. It's very basic logic. And to do that, you have to create the systems, the structure, the habits to do it. And then when you do that, you can add virtually any new strategy you want and fit it into that process and that strategy. And so that's why it's so important to get that digital content kind of system set up, and to do that and to do it well. And then you start doing other things that can fit well into that strategy.
So you say in the book, and I guess this wasn't a surprise, but it was interesting to see it restated in your instance. You say the number one reason you hear why people can't create content is that they don't have time. And the number two reason is that they don't know what to write about. What do you say to them?
Yeah, it's kind of a combination of, with time, it's ultimately a natural barrier, because you can blame it for anybody. If I don't want to hang out with my wife, I just don't have the time. If I don't want to hang out with my best friend, I just don't have the time. If I can't get something done at work, I don't have the time. It's a very, very easy excuse to use, to be honest, with anything. And then in your mind, you feel so self-valued that, well, I'm so busy that, I'm okay with not doing something well because this excuse, it justifies it in my mind and I can feel good about that. When in reality is that it's not good. It's a terrible excuse to have. You don't have the time. You have to do certain things. There's delegating. There's hiring internally. There's outsourcing. I mean, I promise with most companies, the value is there by doing this. You can get the ROI there. So it's not like if I invest this, will I get anything out of it? If you do it well, the ROI is there. That's why there's been such a growth in people that do content marketing well. There's also the struggle of people who don't get any ROI in when they're creating and distributing different types of content. And that is typically because they don't put the right resources towards it. And a lot of times that's justified by the time excuse. And so for me, I just, when I'm coaching or talking to a person who is saying, oh, well, I don't have the time, I say, okay, well, and they're like, well, how do you sit that down there and, write these articles that take 2-3 hours each? And I just simply say, I don't. From the start of me writing, I have never spent more than probably 35 minutes on an article, maybe 40 minutes. It depends if I'm excited about it. But from the start, I knew that, one, I wasn't the strongest writer. I didn't love it, but I did know that I knew it was very important for me to communicate and educate to a specific audience. And so I created a team around me. At first, it was, kind of contracted out, where just because we were a company that didn't really want to put the money towards and didn't have the money back then. But now that we, as soon as we have that budget, I mean, we have a content team of 3 to 4 people that work between myself, my co-founder, and some others on our team just to generate our content and to help us gain trust. And so there's really, as much as I'd love to say, okay, it's a good excuse, you can always use it, time ends up being a non-excuse, because typically you can do things around it, even if it's baby steps to get past those barriers.
Yeah, and I don't know that, it's really not about the time, it's about the priority. Because when something becomes a priority, somehow time presents itself. Now, you say 35 minutes, but there's a process you go through. In other words, are you saying it's you never spend more than 30 minutes working on some content, but that's like 30 minutes at a time?
Sure. Yeah. What I would say is, 30 minutes. I was just on a specific article. And so I'm a big fan of, whether it's a leader or a professional, is that you play to your strength. You play to what you're best at, and also where your time is most valuable. Like, where is it most valuable to be used? Is my time at this point, or at any point, make sense to be spending writing, going back and forth with the editors, do all that? No, it's not. And I know that, and the team knows that. And so for me, it's when it comes to priorities, I look at it and I say, okay, well, we know this is a general priority. The content within our company, is it the number one priority? Might not be at different times. So for a lot of people, if it's not a priority, it still is important. And you have to look at it and say, okay, well, what do they need from me? So like in from our content, what do they need from me? And honestly, to do that, they need experience, they need insights, they need personal anecdotes, because you don't want the content to be, completely BS, fully ghostwritten, not personal, not authentic. And so for our process, it's similar to what our clients go through, but I go through where my team sends me questions and ideas about what's going on that really the audience needs to hear about and be educated on. And I brain dump my thoughts on it. So it could be about, how marketing is evolving. They'll send me an email that says, well, we have technology that sends it to us now. So I can actually just get a notification. Then I go in and I just brain dump my thoughts. So I just talk about, okay, this is how marketing is evolving. We're seeing it being used in recruiting. We're seeing it being used in investor communications. We're seeing it being used in all these other ways. And I'll sit there and just brain dump my thoughts. I'll give some examples of some companies I see using it, and then I will send it off. Now, that's something that somebody else on my team probably couldn't do, because I'm out speaking, talking to these people more than anybody else. And so that's where my time is does make sense to prioritize, because they need that to really make our content stand out, or to at least make it authentic so people feel that they can relate to it and feel like they're talking to actually people that know what they're talking about and have those real experiences. And so then my team creates the content, they send it back to me, I approve it, and then it goes to them, they edit it, polish it, goes to publication, specifically to a target publication. We don't farm it out and say, hey, whoever wants it has it. We target
like the old days of PR.
Create content specifically for that. Exactly. And that's where one of the big problems is that when they see your content in weird places that don't make sense, I mean, you lose trust. It's like, why is this person here? You want to talk to the right people and you want to engage the right people. So I would rather reach 500 of the right people than a million of the wrong people. And that's what happens. Like, I have very good case studies, examples of how I published an article in Forbes, it's got 500,000 views, and I haven't got one lead or really general opportunity from it. And then I got published a article that was 500 or 1,000 views, and we got one of our largest brand clients out of it. And I had five or six people reach out to me. I mean, it's very clear that what's important is not the ego of how many people I'm reaching. It's who am I targeting? Am I getting them in the right way? Am I building trust? And is it generating opportunity for our company and myself?
Yeah. Let's talk about transparency. You talk about authentic transparency. Can you explain, as it relates to your content, why is that so much more important than a lot of people realize?
Well, because it's just rare, to be honest with you. People are, if you look at some of the content that's out there, I mean, I was reading some entrepreneurial content that was even just posted on Facebook, and it was talking about how, the most successful entrepreneurs have helicopters, have the hottest spouses, have limos, and have private jets, take pictures of yourself. Like, I'm seeing more and more of that, and I'm like, that's crap. I know two or three of those people that were posting that are almost bankrupt. And it's just, there's so much BS in the world sometimes, specifically with content. And we have an opportunity when you want to gain trust with someone, you want to be transparent. You want them to feel like they're talking to someone who's very, very real. And I'm not saying, post your financials on your post. You don't have to go extreme where they know every little thing, or you're talking about your biggest fear or something like that. I'm talking about just, think about what are the things that you can open up to an audience where they can relate to you more and they can feel connected to your brand, your company. And the example I give in the book, and I always use this as the prime example, I think it was one of the best ones in the last 4 years that caught me off guard, was Jeff Jones from Target, who wrote an article on LinkedIn about how they were struggling and how they were somewhat lost and trying to get back on track. That was so rare to ever see anybody do that at a big brand. And there's so many big brands that end up sucking at certain parts of their, of their business cycle. And they just still, we're doing fine. Everything's great. And Jeff didn't do that. He was very honest. And that post got, I think, 300,000, 400,000 views the first day. Ad Age, every other place picked it up. I found myself in a Target just for some reason feeling better about being in a Target. I can't say I felt worse. I didn't feel good in a Target, but felt better. And that was a good example of how, whether it's an article or just communicating with someone and being real with them, you can gain a lot of trust just if somebody feels like they're talking to somebody who's real or a company who's real and cares about them.
Yeah, and related to that, can you say a bit about the importance of likability? That seems to get glossed over.
For likability, it's just like it's so funny that like how likability has affected how I look at how you engage with others because in the last 4 or 5 years. I didn't value it as much before. I was like, you don't have to like someone to deal with them, which you don't. I mean, that statement's true. But when it comes to people doing business with others or other companies, likability is one of the biggest factors. There are so many companies that I know that pay $100,000 a year retainers on PR and other and content marketing simply because they really like the big agency they've worked with for 10 years, even though a smaller boutique agency could come in and probably offer the same value for, let's say, $20,000 or $30,000. It's remarkable how much likability affects everyday life. And also, it helps you grow a business. It helps you limit brand negative brand advocates. Even if somebody does a very poor job, and I'll give you an example because I'll be very honest, is that there have been a couple clients where we didn't offer a good service to. It was through a growth spurt where when I looked at it, I'm like, damn, we could have done a lot better. But they liked us. And so they, even though they had the right, and they probably should have, posted a bad review somewhere, they probably should have gone to their friend and said, hey, I had a bad experience here, like warning you not to deal with them. They didn't. And they did it because they liked us. And they knew we tried, we had good intention, we just failed, to be honest with you. And that's something where likability affects so many different areas like that, that if you just present yourself as a likable, and I'm not saying that you're fluffy and just trying to be the nice sweetheart. I'm saying that you present, you're like, what do you, like for me, like respect, loyalty, transparency, those are things that I consider in a likable person. It's not that somebody just feeds my ego. I'd rather have somebody give me constructive feedback than to just say, oh, you're awesome. And so think about those factors of what you consider a likable person and likable brand. And if you start, you know, every kind of day taking a step towards being that more likable brand, there will be more opportunity. And so that's why I put a chapter of the book about it.
Yeah. And it also, not related to this, but it brings to mind, I think I've heard that there have been studies that have shown that physicians with better bedside manners tend to be sued less.
Yeah, that's actually good, man. Why didn't I put that in the book? That would have been good. But like, I look at that as like, we should all challenge ourselves to do that. And in this book process, I found out that I wasn't as likable as I wanted to be. I was like, oh yeah, I'm like, I'm friendly to people, right? And I went through and did the same exercises I was doing for other, like I had a couple speeches where I did a workshop. And one of them was I took these likability lists. One was from Jeff Hayden that I use in the book of, you know, what do you consider a likable person or brand? And I walked through it and I was honest with myself and I was like, oh my gosh, I'm only 4 of these like 11 things or 5 of these 11 things. I was like, that's a problem. And so when you look at that, there's this balance between likability. There's the, in the book I describe it, you can be like the, well, Matt Clark was my high school professor that made us read like 100, it was a ton of books in a semester and was, his tests were the hardest, but it made me better. And he wasn't the nicest guy where he was just like super friendly. He challenged me and made me like, I mean, made me a very, I'm just honestly a better person. And that was so powerful. And I, when I think back, I go, wow, I really respect and like that guy, even though I didn't at the time. And then I also look at the Paul Rudds of the world, who are just the fun, goofy people you want to surround yourself with. Now, those are two ends of the spectrum of likability, and you got to find yourself between those is who do you want to be? And I think in the book, I describe Oprah as being kind of in the middle. I mean, she's fun to be around, goofy. Like, I mean, everybody who's kind of around her on a regular basis is like, yeah, she's fun. She's caring. But she also is a very respectful and challenging to others, too. And so, you know, whether you agree with that or disagree with that, there's people that you can put in there that you can look at and say, how can I be this nice balance? Or do I want to be the Paul Rudd? Or do I want to be the Matt Clarks of the world?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to be Oprah. No, I'm just kidding. So let's talk about personal branding, thought leadership, and company branding. It all is kind of mashed together. And I don't know that a lot of companies are still quite understanding how personal branding, if it's done right and leveraged across their company, can be one of their most important company branding tactics.
I mean, with personal branding, there's a variety of ways why it's one. It's your
vehicle. And explain why you didn't like that term at first.
Well, I don't like it because it seems so selfish and self-centered, is that you're so concerned about how you look and how you're kind of a self-promoter, when in reality is that you're just a vehicle to accomplish a specific goal. So even if you're a consultant, your goal with personal branding is to be a vehicle so that people trust your brand or trust you to consult. And it's not about you. It's more about how you're like, how they perceive how that buyer's journey is. And so that's why, like, I loved when thought leadership started coming around, because really for me, I'm not even sure if that's the right term at this point, but for me, the personal branding involved in the thought leadership, because the fact is that it's not just about the individual. In most cases, it's about using that individual as a vehicle to achieve business goals. Mm-hmm. And so that's where thought leadership came in, because one of those business goals was like, let's lead through thought. Let's get good information out there so the company benefits from it. Whether it's a huge company like a Google or a one-person company, you want the company to benefit and that to be a vehicle, because people can get caught up in, oh my gosh, I need to have this ego fill of feeling like I'm the leader, where in reality, like the things that I want to do with my brand is specifically to accomplish certain things. It's not to make me feel good and to make me feel like I'm above others. And that's the problem, is that sometimes even when I first got into this business, when I walked in these people with personal brands, they put themselves on this pedestal where they almost were like setting a bad example for us young people, because we saw it's like, okay, well, when you build a personal brand, your job is to be on a pedestal. When that's not how I look at things, I think that that's not how you gain trust. I think that the way you gain trust is by earning it. And a lot of times, by looking at it from a standpoint of how can I use my brand in a way that educates these people, that really helps them become better, then to me, there's so much more value and so much more trust that's created. And that's why you see a lot of the people who do that from their personal brand, they build real companies. The people who are the egotistical ones, a lot of times have 1, 2, 5 people, and don't build real like companies with mass value. And a lot of times they go away, you know, they have a brand for a year or two, and then next thing you know, they're done.
Yeah.
And so that's why I think it's very important to be very, very centered around how can I go from personal branding to thought leadership to ultimately branding, using myself as a vehicle to push the company's brand and opportunities forward.
So if you have a company, let's say you're the CEO, can you explain to him or her why some of their key people should be building their own brands and why they shouldn't be worried about, you know, them leaving one day?
Sure. And I'm a big proponent of that, is like, I want to invest in my, there's a Richard Branson quote, I forgot. It's something about like you, how important it is, like treat your employees.
Train your people so they could leave and treat them so well they don't want to.
Yeah,
something
exactly.
Like that.
Exactly. It's something like that. And that stuck with me for a while. And I always tweet that out every like 6 months as a reminder.
Yeah, that's a great one.
It's so important to me to look at that, is that you can't let a barrier of investing and getting your employees where they need to be, being that they always need to leave. That's like saying like, I mean, I always need to do this for like, so my wife doesn't leave me. Like if I was always thinking that way, my wife probably would leave me. I mean, you've got to invest. You've got to do your best to get them where they need to be, you know, to treat them well. And I promise you, there's going to be people leaving. Like, for example, one example I use in the book is Ryan O'Connell. He was one of our VPs. I think he was our 5th or 6th employee. We invested a lot in his brand. We invested in getting content from him. He did some speaking, and it brought a lot of opportunities to us. People really related and liked, you know, got kind of attached to the company and would be pulled in just from, you know, seeing Ryan speak or an article. Now, Ryan ended up leaving in year 3. He ended up working for one of our partners, which is fine. We are happy about it. But honestly, at this point, like, Ryan brings almost as much value as he did when he was a employee of ours. I mean, we get referrals from him. He's out there still advocating for us. And I don't even have to pay a salary at this point. So it's lovely. So it's really great to see that, yeah, you are going to lose employees. I promise you that. However, we also have people who started on that founding team that their brands do help us out. It does help us create opportunities. And it is one of the best ways to consistently get inbound opportunities, is that when people want to deal with people, they want to have this human to human connection. And that's why you see less, that's why branded content, when it has the brand name rather than the individual, it performs. If you A/B test it, if you have the same article and there's an author to it rather than a brand, the author content's always going to perform better. It's like 90% of the time. And the reason why is because people want to connect on a human level with other people and not just brands. And so, you know, as you embrace that across the company, invest in their brands and get them to be these vehicles and advocates for you out, you know, in the external world, you're going to have these inbound opportunities and you're going to lose people here and there. But overall, it's going to keep moving your brand forward, and you'll get people to step up because they'll respect how you invest in brands and get those people, you know, in those positions. And so I've never seen a company do it well and say, damn, I wish we wouldn't have done that, because ultimately, if they do it the right way, they invest across the team. No matter who leaves, there's still this momentum that keeps going up and pushing the brand where it needs to be.
Yeah, I have a friend who's a founder and president of a company, and they were at one point, they were on the Inc. 5000, and he trained his people really well, and they would do training every day. It was an HVAC company. And his competitors would say, well, you know, what happens if they leave? And his response was always, what happens if they stay?
I like that quote. That's exactly how I feel. Like,
yeah.
That's a really good one. I'm gonna write that down and steal it and attribute it.
Please, please do. So, a couple other nuts and bolts questions I wanted to ask that I think would be very helpful for the listener is: what do you say to the person who thinks my industry is boring, so my content will be too?
If you want to talk about boring, one of our first clients was Leggett & Platt. Nobody is more boring than Leggett & Platt. They invented the bed spring. And so they make beds. And so anybody who thinks that they can't make content interesting is wrong, because in that case study, we did a series of articles around the best mattresses for sex. They had done a study related to that. They found out that men would side with women more on purchasing decisions if they thought the mattress was going to be better for sex. And so what we did is we got content from the several of the leaders of the company and got it published. One got published in Washington Post. One got published in a variety of different places, niche blogs, publications. But it was extremely successful. It actually was, it was real thought leadership creativity, there was creative thought leadership going on. And it actually did help. They were able to use that in sales campaigns and sales enablement. And to be honest, like, I'm not saying that we're trying to create a campaigns or encouraging you to, okay, how can you turn your boring business into something sex related?
But it's not an excuse.
It's not an excuse. I've never ran into somebody who has a boring business that you can't find some angle. That's exactly what, you know, when we started working Leggett & Platt, it was the same thing. But all that matters is the angles and what's valuable to your customer. And when you really put yourself and find out what's valuable to them, there's a lot of interesting things. There's a ton of interesting things. I mean, we worked with AIG, who AIG is the most exciting company, but they also insure some of the most interesting things in the world that you would never know. I don't know if it's like, actor's butt or something, but there's different things like that that they insure that was so intriguing to find out about. And I never even knew. And as a, you know, as someone who goes out there, speaks and talks about different brands, for me to hear that, I was like, man, I thought AIG was boring. But in reality, there's these interesting facts. You just have to find out, one, what could be interesting. Two, what could be valuable to them or educational that could help them become better? And three, what's just what's something that is kind of the mix between the two that you can potentially have, you know, engaging, entertaining, but then it really has a good educational element to it, where for that, it could be like we did some content around our investor adventures. They buy boring businesses. So we talked about that and we kind of had some fun parts about it, but it was really educational about what boring businesses can do to make themselves more attractive to be bought.
Yeah, I have a friend in Kalamazoo, Michigan, Dan Moyle. He's with AmeriFirst Mortgage Company. And at the Inbound conference a few years ago, he gave a talk on producing content if you're in a boring industry or whatever. So many people came to that talk. He had to do like 2 or 3 encore presentations in bigger rooms in successive days. it was just amazing. So clearly a lot of people think that, you know, oh, well, we're so boring. Not true. Not Mm-mm. true at all. So, John, if readers took only one thing away from the book, what would you hope it would be?
For me, like, I'm a big believer that a book will not, like, a lot of times not change your life fully. I think but the best ways to actually get books to change your life is you take core elements or different parts about it from it. And if it was a good read, you know, if it's a good read and it's fun, and that's why I on purpose made it so that it was a little more easy to read than getting caught up where you kind of get stuck on pages. I wanted it to be like that because I wanted it to just get people to think how they engage others and to kind of shift this, like not just in marketing, but just how you communicate. And that's what I wanted. I wanted people to think about it from a standpoint is when I get done reading this book, how am I thinking about how I communicate to my best friend, how I communicate to my wife, how I communicate to my mom, how I communicate to my neighbor, how I communicate to in marketing, how our brand communicates. And I think that when you actually take a step back and think about how you truly can build trust, like my goal over time with this book is so when people read it, it just slightly gets them to think how they can create these habits that are more engaging, that do help not just, you know, the digital content landscape, which I think is a huge area that needs help. There's so much crap content out there that's just about me-centric content where it's destroying the internet. So I would say the two goals of mine is that if you walk away and you contribute to a healthier digital landscape by creating more valuable, engaging content, huge win for me. I'm on like a complete, like, not, I don't want to say war, but I'm on this journey to try and make the digital landscape with better, more engaging content. So if you can help towards that, I'd love you for that. And then also just how you engage others. I think that if you walk away and you, what my book helps you do is just helps you have a better relationship with your team, has a better relationship with a potential client, have a better relationship with one of your executives. Like if it can slightly help you think about them a little more and how you're gaining trust touch points to improve those relationships, that would be a huge win for me, because that's what's happened to me the last 5 years of looking at this and trying these things out and seeing other entrepreneurs use these tactics. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't happy. Like, I mean, I was happy in ways, but I truly wasn't to the full potential of how content I could be in my life. And more success has happened since then as well. So that's what I hope that someone walks away with, just those little changes. And if it can contribute to one of those areas, I'm extremely thrilled.
Well, here's what I liked, amongst other things in the book, is that you explain some rather big concepts in a way that was very concise and succinct. And even tomorrow, we're doing a content workshop for a new client, and there are a few things from your book that we're bringing with us to help in this workshop, to help their whole organization get on board. So kudos to you. Thank you, and I'm already using your book. What books have inspired your working career?
I mean, one that happened recently, and I like him a lot, is Simon Sinek. Is that he wrote like Start With Why and Leaders Eat Less, thought it was a brilliant, simple thing. Think about how your company is operating and why you do what you do, not just as a company but as an individual. So I think that's probably, if I had one in the last 5 years, that was one that probably made the biggest impact. Adam Grant with Give and Take is another one.
Yeah, we'll make sure to have links to those books in the show notes at marketingbookpodcast.com. And one thing we didn't have time to talk about was the way the Start With Why idea from Simon Sinek is very applicable and can be baked into your content creation. So how best can listeners learn more about you and your book?
So I have a site. If you just go to influenceandco.com/John Hall, or you just type in John Hall speaking, you'll see the links that come up. Those are my speaking site. There'll be more information on the book. The book's already on Amazon, so you can go there and pre-order it. Something I tell people, and I just started offering this last week, is that simply put, if you want me to personalize a book for a group, like let's say you have a team of 10 people or 20 people that you want me to personalize something towards them, I will actually write it and I will do whatever you want me to put in there.
Okay, great. The name of the book is Top of Mind: Use Content to Unleash Your Influence and Engage Those Who Matter to You. The author is John Hall. John, thank you very much for being on the Marketing Book Podcast.
Hey, thanks, Doug. It was good catching up.
And that closes the book on episode 120 of the Marketing Book Podcast. Links to everything linkable in the interview you just listened to are at marketingbookpodcast.com. And that's also where you can sign up for the Marketing Book Podcast newsletter so you never miss an episode. And if your next event needs some inspiration and entertainment, I'd be happy to present to your group key insights from over 100 marketing and sales books that have been featured on the Marketing Book Podcast. To contact me, just go to marketingbookpodcast.com and leave a message, or connect with me on LinkedIn. My name again is Douglas Burdett. Or send me a tweet at my Twitter handle, marketingbook. I look forward to hearing from you. And please join us next time as we welcome Sean Ellis to the show to talk about the new book he has co-authored with Morgan Brown, Hacking Growth: How Today's Fastest Growing Companies Drive Breakout Success. Thanks again for listening to the Marketing Book Podcast.